Welcome to Sharkpedia. We're your hosts, Megan
and Imani,
a couple of shark researchers that want to bring the science to you.
We're creating a space to learn all things sharks
and their relatives,
answer your questions,
and learn from the legends in the field.
Get ready to jump in.
Let's dive deep into the world of sharks.
Hello, Sharkies. We are back with another Sharkpedia episode. We are so excited to have Dr. Fraser here today. We're going to be talking about tooth regeneration, which I am super psyched about. Dr. Fraser, would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for inviting me. So my name is Gareth Fraser. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Florida, Department of Biology. I'm currently in Northern Ireland, so I'm on a bit of a tour of Europe right now. I head to Italy next week for a conference. So I study tooth development and evolution more specifically. My background is in vertebrate paleontology. I started my undergraduate degree studying paleontology and evolution. Moved on to do my master's in genetics, and I was actually working on sharks quite a bit during my master's. And then I studied genetics, and then I wanted to combine development and genetics by studying Evo-Devo. My PhD. So that's where I sort of really got involved with understanding a bit more about the genetics behind tooth development and why fish make teeth and how they regenerate and that sort of stuff. So from there, I've sort of based my career on that sort of principle of tooth development and regeneration. And we've spanned, I think, quite far out from there now. But my sort of primary focus is still tooth development and regeneration on sharks, typically.
Super cool. We're really excited to go over this paper. I learned a lot of things, longer than a list probably. Every new sentence I think was a new thing I was learning. So I'm really excited to have our listeners kind of get some more information from you and really understand how cool teeth are in fish. So Megan, would you like to introduce the article that we're going to be reading today and then also read us the summary?
Yeah, you got it. We're going over Dr. Fraser's research, the dental lamina, an essential structure for perpetual tooth regeneration in sharks. We love regeneration in sharks. We just had Yulia on our podcast a couple weeks ago, and we are really excited to kind of dive into actually how all those teeth are regenerating. So the summary for this paper is methods of studying evolutionary development and regenerative biology have been improving over the past few years. This paper utilizes the embryonic small spotted cat shark, Scylorhinus canicula, using new techniques that allow them to research key developmental and regenerative processes that classical models cannot. The development of shark teeth and their subsequent regeneration is a lesser studied area of research, and Fraser et al. Explore the role of dental lamina, the tissue that is the first evidence of teeth in an embryo, and in the development of highly regenerative dentition in sharks. Sharks regenerate whole teeth at a time, as opposed to other systems such as the Murin model, where incisors exhibit continuous renewal and growth at the same tooth. Studying shark teeth on a genetic level can provide important context into the evolution of vertebrate tooth regeneration. So we're going to go over the crazy, crazy adaptation that sharks have to just keep replacing their entire tooth. So cool.
So this paper is a symposium paper, which is the first time that we're having any sort of article on like this. So can you just explain to our listeners what a symposium paper is?
Sure. Yeah. So symposium or symposia papers are papers that are typically associated with a symposium. And so in our case, a colleague and I were able to collect a bunch of experts in the field of tooth biology together, and we presented a symposium at SICBI, which is the Society of Integrative and Comparative Biology conference, and that was, I think, in Austin before the pandemic started, so January 2020 or something like that. And yeah, so basically what happens is there's a journal associated with that, so Integrative and Comparative Biology. And the idea is that, you know, symposia typically will collect together some of those experts, and they will write a paper, sometimes together. So we did we actually published, I think, two papers in that journal. One was a sort of a collection of all that we know up to date, sort of, you know, general information about tooth biology from all the experts that we sort of collected as part of the symposium. And then individual groups would write their own papers associated with that topic. So yeah, so this is a paper that I wrote as a sort of summary of my work, and focus primarily on the shark dental lamina, which is a really important structure that is able to regenerate, or at least is part of the structure that's capable of regeneration of teeth in sharks.
That is awesome. So can you help us out with some of the terminology? You explained that sharks are odontodes, right? And that there are differences between odontodes and true teeth. Can you explain what odontodes are and what the differences are between those things?
Yeah, sure. So so all teeth are odontodes, right? But odontodes also sort of expand beyond teeth, right? So if you think about all of the vertebrates that have ever lived, right? So including fossil vertebrates as well. Some of those would have had skin appendages or skin coverings that would have contained a dentine kind of structure, or a dentine and enamel structure. So both or just dentine. And some bone potentially. And so the collection of those components are what we term as an odontode, right? So something that has dentine, enamel, or just dentine, sometimes just enamel, maybe with or without a bony component. So it's any sort of tooth-like material that's found in the mouth or outside the mouth. So that's an odontode. And so true teeth, in my sort of strange definition of what true teeth are, and we don't really know what true teeth really are, but in my definition, true teeth are teeth that have a very sort of characteristic oral or pharyngeal characters that mean that they contain this structure called the dental lamina, which enables their continuous regeneration, or at least their partial or multiple regenerative capacities. So not all odontos will have a dental lamina, but teeth do. And I think that I'm trying to sort of define teeth as a very sort of unique structure, given the fact that they have this dental lamina and associated tissues that other odontos may not have. That's not to say that other odontos don't have the ability to regenerate. There might be just a slightly different mechanism involved. And so the way that I sort of look to distinguish those two is that, you know, teeth and dermal denticles in sharks are all odontodes, but dermal denticles aren't necessarily teeth, right? So they're just different, right? They don't regenerate in the same way. There's not a dental lamina associated with dermal denticles. It's more of a reparative regeneration. So if a denticle's lost, or it gets to the end of its shelf life, so it's shed via whatever mechanism that's involved, or there's some wounding and denticles and the skin has to regenerate and then denticles have to reform, that's a different mechanism of regeneration to the teeth. So the teeth are on this kind of autonomous sort of conveyor belt almost. And that's the case of all teeth that regenerate, right? So you have one tooth in the jaw and it's replaced by another tooth that's coming. And in the sharks and in lots of other vertebrates, for example, reptiles and amphibians, it may be that you have several different generations of teeth that are being made ahead of function, right? And so the crazy thing about shark teeth is that if you section through or you look through the jaw of a shark, you'll see not only the functional tooth positions, but the teeth behind it. And all those teeth behind it are the regenerative teeth, so the replacement teeth. They're all within that dental lamina. And they're all sort of being made in slightly different stages. So it's actually a stage series of development from a functional tooth that's attached to the jaw through stages of different types of cusp formation, all the way down to the end of the lamina where you have nothing, just a ball of cells, which contains stem cells. And that little ball of cells will eventually make a new generation. And so those teeth are sort of added to that conveyor belt. They're shed at the end of that conveyor belt after functionality, right? So it's just the idea is that teeth regenerate in a very different way to other odontodes. I think that's the point.
Does the dental lamina cover the whole, like, jaw that the teeth are in?
Yeah, in sharks it does. And in some other vertebrates too, it does. But not in all vertebrates, right? So if you think about all vertebrates that have teeth, their dental lamina may be associated with an individual tooth, right? So every tooth will have a little bit of epithelium under the jaw or within the jaw, and that little spit of cells is called the dental lamina, and that will make a new tooth for that one position. But sharks are kind of interesting in that they have this, what we call a continuous and permanent dental lamina. So it covers the entirety of the jaw. So if you were to take off the lower jaw of a shark and look down on it, what you would see is the functional tooth positions and nothing else. You'd see skin that covers all of that area. And it's that skin, actually, in between the functional teeth and the tongue, that skin is the sort of the dental lamina that's diving deep into the jaw, because those teeth that you can't see are present within that tissue, and they're developing sort of, you know, in that sort of recess of the cartilage. So it's kind of interesting, actually, the anatomy of this whole thing. But the dental lamina shark is incredibly big compared to most other vertebrates, right? So it covers the entirety of the jaw. So it's jaw wide, and all the teeth are then connected by this continuous dental lamina.
So if you were someone who like didn't know the word dental lamina, like for just a regular lay person, and you looked at a person's gums, not gums, you looked at a shark's mouth, the dental lamina would probably be what you would call gums, even though that's not the correct term for it.
Well, maybe not, right? So if you look, and I'm sure some of your listeners have seen this, right? They've either seen firsthand the great white's mouth, or they've looked at pictures of the great white's mouth. What you'll see between the teeth is this kind of pink stuff, right?
Right.
And so that's interesting. So that pink stuff in between the teeth and the great white, for example, between those functional positions, that's not really dental lamina.
Oh.
So the dental lamina sort of dives sort of like behind those functional teeth and behind. So they do have gums, and actually the gums in the shark are also this kind of, you know, keratin-rich, hard stuff, basically. It's kind of connective tissue and fibrous connective tissues.
Right.
And that's the same material that helps to attach the tooth to the jaw itself. But the dental lamina is really soft and fleshy, and it's an epithelial tissue that's behind those functional teeth. So it's kind of the spongy stuff that also contains taste buds, by the way. But it's the spongy stuff that you can sort of like touch and probably depress and play with behind the functional teeth. So if you were to push, you know, slightly harder, you could probably feel some of those tooth positions kind of almost ready to pop out, right?
Cool.
But it's quite deep, right? So and you know, if you think about some of your listeners may already have seen this, but if you take a jaw and you've prepped the jaw, so you've got all the soft tissue removed, if you look inside the jaw, you can probably see that the replacement teeth are kind of folded into this kind of recess, this kind of furrow that's sort of like at the deep base of the cartilage on the inside of the jaw. And that's where the dental lamina sits, in that sort of recess, right? So it sort of carves out this kind of little area, kind of a niche where the new teeth are being formed.
I'm fascinated by this. This is really cool.
Yeah, thank you so much. That was such a good explanation, and I definitely learned something new today.
We're at the 14 minute mark.
So how is the ectomesenchymal condensate related to the dental lamina? You bring that up a couple times.
Oh boy. Now you've touched on something quite tricky. So the dental lamina itself. Okay. So I should back up a bit. So tooth development itself starts in all vertebrates. It's sort of a collaboration between two cell types. You have the overlying dental epithelium, right, or oral epithelium as it is before it becomes competent to make teeth, and this underlying sort of mesenchymal tissue, right? It's called ectomesenchyme in teeth, in craniofacial biology, because it kind of emanates as neurocrest from the neurocrest, which is ectoderm, essentially. This is getting really complicated now, and this is very kind of complicated developmental biology. But essentially, the cells that migrate, so these neurocrest cells that migrate from the neural tube closure, which are ectodermal, migrate down into the jaws and other parts of the head during very early embryogenesis. And it sort of contributes. It's not the entirety of the ectomesenchyme, but it contributes to that tissue. So it's the sort of underlying cell layer that is basically underlying that epithelium, right? And so if you think about teeth are a beautiful sort of collaboration between these two tissue types, because the upper layer, the epithelium, will become oral epithelium. And will become dental epithelium, and it starts to thicken. So once it sort of activates the competence to make teeth, so it initiates tooth development, this upper layer will start to thicken, right? And that thickening will basically pocket into the mesenchyme below, right? And that mesenchyme will then start to condense. So a lot of those mesenchymal cells will start to condense and concentrate around that bulb of cells that will start to invade the mesenchyme, right? So that starts the whole process of tooth development. So that sort of three-dimensional blob is the first tooth germ, right?
Is this in all age stages or is this just in neonate development?
No, that's a great question. So the mesenchyme itself is really important for all stages of tooth development, right? And so what's interesting is that the upper layer, the epithelium, will actually, some of those cells, not all, but some of those cells will differentiate into the ameloblasts. So they're the cells that will lay down the enamel of the tooth, right? And the mesenchymal cells, some of those cells will differentiate into things, pulp and other things, but importantly, they'll differentiate into the odontoblasts. And these are the cells that lay down dentine. And in order to get a true tooth, right, so a tooth that's made of enamel and dentine, you need both those cell types to be laying down. It's a little bit more complicated than fishes because actually the odontoblasts, so these mesenchymal cells, have the propensity to make both tissues. It's so strange. And then the epithelial cells will sort of lay down this kind of like interesting cap on top of that.
What?
It's wacky.
I don't think I ever knew that shark teeth could be so complicated.
Oh, it's more complicated than even I want to sort of understand. But the important thing is you need those two cell types to make a tooth, right? Mm-hmm. So you need the epithelium, the overlying epithelium, and the underlying mesenchyme, and those two tissue types have to be there together. And it's important because the signals, so the gene networks that are involved in making a tooth, will signal between those two tissue layers. So they're basically to orchestrate the whole process, right? So so if you don't have, and we know this from lots of studies in mammalian biology and even human syndromes, that if some of those genes don't signal in the right cells, you misalign your teeth or you get no teeth, essentially, right? And so if you think about a shark dentition, it's incredibly precise in its formation, in its patterning. And so if any of those things go awry, right, the chances of all those teeth sort of like forming in that precise way start to shift, and so you might get a slightly weird dentition. So it's really imperative, I think, if you're an animal, whether a shark or anything else that has a very specific diet, you need your teeth to be formed in a very specific way, right?
Do you see mutations where that happens, where they don't match up and then the teeth aren't developing correctly
in sharks?
Yeah,
you do. Yeah, and it's rare, and you can imagine why it's rare, because if you're a shark that doesn't have the right dentition, you might not be able to eat, and so you might not survive so long, right? So yeah, but you do see them. There are reports of lots of reports of these kind of pathological conditions in sharks where the dentine or the enamel haven't formed properly, or you get some divisions in the actual patterning of the teeth itself, or you get damage, right? And so that's the other thing that we see quite well, it's still quite rare, but it's more common that there's these sort of syndromic issues where the shark jaw is damaged somehow by fishing gear or propeller damage or a fight with a seal or something, but you do see damage more so. And then actually what happens is the shark dentition and the dental laminate itself will try to repair that damage, and often it's not successful.
Interesting. Oh my gosh, wow. That's so cool.
Yeah. So speaking of all these dental issues and adaptations, in your introduction you mentioned how dental development has evolved between taxa, including sequentially initiated mammalian molars and continuously growing mouse incisors. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there is an advantage to having continuously sequential teeth as we see in sharks over other adaptations?
I think the one thing that you guys mentioned in the summary is that, you know, sharks are able to make whole teeth, right? Now that's huge because we have lots of conditions where in mammals, for example, you're able to sort of add to a tooth, right? So an incisor, for example, of a mouse or rat. These incisors continue to grow. That's why they're so good at eating through your cables and your walls, right? Or your pantry or whatever it is, but those incisors, yeah, I know, right? And so those incisors continually grow throughout their life, and they're sort of worn down by the way they eat and how they and what they eat. And actually, there's a shear surface based on the fact that they have enamel on the outer edge and not on the inner edge, so it's able to create that shear surface, right? So the teeth can essentially act like scissors, right?
Cool. Anyway, but, I didn't but know that.
So, but that continuous progression of that's regeneration. It's a similar type of regeneration, right? We have stem cell niches that allow new cells to sort of enter that sort of that cell line to produce enamel or dentine or whatever it is they need to make in support of that tooth. But it's essentially the same tooth sort of being added to. So it's a continuously grown tooth. Whereas in sharks, they're actually regenerating new teeth every generation, right? Every time. So in some sharks, that's every 2 weeks, right? Which is pretty incredible.
So crazy.
So yeah, so that's, I mean, it depends on the shark species. Like a great white that makes those quite big teeth, they're probably made every 300 days, maybe every year. So I don't know what the sort of process is. We haven't really been able to get a good handle on the rate of tooth replacement in some of the big sharks. But yeah, so if you're making brand new teeth, that's really huge. And so biomedically speaking, that's really important, because what that means is that there is a mechanism in nature that makes new whole teeth, right? And as a human species, we would like more teeth probably, right? So we're growing older, our diets are getting worse. And so medical science is allowing us to stay alive for longer, which means that probably we're getting to a point where we might need a third or fourth generation of teeth, right?
Yeah.
And so, we could, and so if you can study some things like sharks that are able to make whole new teeth, that means you can sort of, basically try and find out how they do that and see if there's a way you can sort of trigger that in humans at some point.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I was actually going to ask you that. Like, do you think there's a way that we could genetically put into our DNA to like replace
more teeth?
Yeah. Well, so that's, a bunch of groups around the world are doing this, right? Whether it's studying mice or studying cells. So actually sort of like taking components of the tooth systems of the cells, culturing them to try and see if they can sort of force tooth development in culture. But actually I'm going sort of like the other route and looking at, fish that do it naturally, right? So how are sharks able to do it? And then compare that to human tissues to say, okay, if sharks can do it and they make new teeth continuously through life, why don't humans do that? And so can we compare those same cells, the same genes, to find out what it is in the human sort of system or human biology more generally that's removed from that system? And that could give us those clues to suggest that maybe those are the things we need to turn back on in humans. So the good news is humans can make new teeth, right? We already have two sets. So we have the capacity to regenerate our dentition once. Why do we stop, right? And even that sort of that in adolescence, we're continuing that process of tooth regeneration because we're adding molars to the back of our jaw, right? So if you're unlucky enough to have a wisdom tooth, that's the sort of the extended sort of capacity of the dental lamina to make a new tooth. So if you think about molars, right, molar 1, 2, 3, they develop in sequence. And at the back of the jaw, there's a little blob of cells that is essentially the dental lamina that doesn't really know where to go next, because in humans we don't have that fourth tooth. And so it just starts to break down, like all other dental epithelia. It starts to break down over time. So the possibilities are that we could sort of, harvest some of those cells at the back of the jaw or associated with other teeth that we're losing or removed for whatever reason, culture them, and then basically start the process again and then reimplant those cells back into the gaps that we need to fill.
What? So am I a superior human being because I have all four of my wisdom teeth that grew in? Or am I just unlucky?
No, I think that means that we're not advanced humans, right? So it seems that we don't need those teeth necessarily, right? So they're actually a problem. Right. Our jaws are not quite big enough to kind of house those, right? So if you have them, I have all four too, and it's a problem. But so some humans don't make that third molar, right? Which is kind of crazy because, the jaws just can't physically house that. And so, so it could be that the sort of the evolution of humans are sort of losing teeth. So we're losing that position. So if you have them, maybe you're not such an advanced human. I don't know.
I'm a loser.
then I am too, right? So I have no proof.
I knew someone once that had 7 wisdom teeth.
Oh, that's brutal.
Ow.
And had to get them all removed and like...
Of course.
You touched on a really good point though, that there are some humans that have weird teeth, right? And so they might have a third generation or at least the start of a third generation. And so it could be that our systems are sort of, predisposed to making new generations of teeth. And then for some reason that, they stop. Most people stop them after 2, but in some cases they kind of keep adding and they're like, what's going on? Right. But that's not natural, right? I mean, it's natural if you're a vertebrate. Think about the evolution of vertebrates, but not as a human, right? So,
yeah. So I think you answered one of my questions, which was, we don't really know why, like what the differences are in between why, we only have 2, well, I guess 1 replacement of teeth in comparison to sharks or other animals. We just don't really know why we don't have that.
It's a good question. We don't really know why. We have a good idea we have a good idea. We just don't know the specifics behind that sort of evolutionary process. But I guess the best guess is that if you're a mammal, right, like us, and you know, mammals evolved a dentition that, depending on the group of animal, they eat a very specific diet, right? And so what we think is that actually, if you want your teeth to occlude, and so occlusion is a term that refers to the teeth coming together, right? So your upper teeth and lower teeth coming together as a sort of unit, right? If you think about your molars, if you kind of grind your teeth, they should come together perfectly, and you're able to grind down sort of plant matter, right? So we're omnivorous, we eat lots of different things. But if you think about a cow or a ruminant or something that eats a very specific diet, so like just grasses or, you know, silica-rich grasses or something, if their teeth don't occlude, they may not be able to process that grass and get the nutrients out that they need, right? And so that occlusion, the coming together of the teeth, is quite important. Now, what we think is that mammals require that process more so than more teeth. And so if you reduce the number of rounds of tooth replacement, then you're more likely to get that occlusion and keep it, right? If you were to regenerate your teeth more times, the chances of those teeth misaligning are quite high, right? So in order for those teeth to actually operate together, you probably don't want to replace them so much, right? And so that's
kind of... That makes such good sense.
Yeah, and so that's kind of like our best guess as to why this may have happened. And, you know, humans are mammals, you know, we're sort of, you know, I guess derived mammals in the sense that our teeth can do different things, but, and we have different shaped teeth, but essentially we're sort of using that same sort of guide, right? So that same evolutionary guide where, you know, you lose the number of replacements in order to keep that grinding propensity up.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Now I'm thinking about when I'm at the dentist and they do fillings and then they have to like shave it down so that my teeth can like grind together correctly.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But you notice it too. If they don't quite shave it down enough and you get it to hurts. Bite down, it's like, oh, that feels so strange and it's not right.
Yeah.
So then you think of sharks, you go, well, I'm sure there are sharks that occlude. Not really. No, sharks don't really occlude, right? So they might have molariform teeth or these grinding teeth, but they're really there to sort of break or to crush things and not so finely grind things down between the teeth, right?
Right. Sand tiger teeth to me are so funny because they just are like not formed together at all. They're just like going in every direction.
but they don't come together, right? So if you ever see them eat,
no,
those teeth never really come together. And if they did, that would be a problem because they might sort of like shear or break or something.
Yeah, no kidding. I also wondered, you said that teeth between taxa, so like between fish and mammals, are made of the same mineral composition. Does this surprise you that we haven't seen teeth created of different mineral compositions? We've just kind of conserved it throughout evolution.
Yeah. And so that term conservation is a term that really refers to that sort of sharing of both genetic and sort of structural components through evolution, right? So it's basically homology, right? It's the ability to, you know, your ancestors will share the same genetic code that you have, right? So that's a conservation of your genes and your, you know, genetic information. So that's true. It is a surprise because I think, you know, the diversity of teeth and the sort of diversity of vertebrates, you may think that there may be some things out there that just do it slightly differently. And, you know, there are actually, if you think about sort of weird vertebrates like lampreys or hagfish, so they have teeth, they're probably made in a very similar way and they're probably arranged in a very similar pattern too, but they're made of keratin, right? And so this is kind of hardened keratin. It's not dentine or enamel. And then again, there are things that only make teeth with dentine. So that's kind of strange, maybe. They don't have that enamel cap. Even some mammals do that. But yeah, if I could complicate things even more. So enamel isn't enamel across the board, right? So enamel is a sort of hydroxyapatite material, super hard. So it's hypermineralized, super hard. It's the hardest known biological material. In mammals, we call it enamel. In some reptiles, we might call it enamel, but then lower vertebrates, we call it enameloid because it's slightly different in its sort of structural composition. But it's essentially the same material, right?
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
When you read like dentical papers, they call it enameloid.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. And so just not to get bogged down with the sort of chemistry of those things, they're pretty much the same in most respects. It's just the way they're laid down is slightly different, but essentially it's the same. And I don't know if there are enough differences to say that it isn't enamel or enamel-like tissue, right? And so the dentine seems to be the same, although there are lots of divisions of dentine, lots of definitions of what type of dentine you might have. But yeah, but the general component of a tooth hasn't really changed that much since its conception, 450 or so million years ago, right? So that's quite mind-boggling, I think, that, you know, our teeth,
so too,
you know, are pretty much unchanged since the dawn of teeth.
I know.
But yeah, I mean, there are other strange things that happen. So some animals are able to sequester some mineral or additional minerals within their teeth to sort of strengthen them somehow. I mean, if you think of rodents, you might see that they've got yellow teeth. That's not because they don't wash their teeth or brush their teeth. It's actually because they sequester this kind of these iron rich components of into their teeth. So they kind of, they add sort of some, it's almost like reinforcement to the teeth to make them slightly more hard or less resistant, right? So it's kind of interesting. And some fish do that too. There are some fish, like cichlids, for example, that have gold teeth as well, gold pharyngeal teeth, because they also sequester this this iron component to their teeth. It's kind of interesting. So yeah, so there are things that are sort of trying to sort of increase the hardness of their teeth somewhat, or at least increase the resistance or resilience of those teeth, yeah. But yeah, I'm surprised too that the structure of teeth is essentially unchanged since the dawn of the first dentition.
It's so cool. It's so interesting.
It's pretty cool.
And it's, yeah. It's, the other thing that the thing that I'm like stuck on right now is like the fossil record and how well that has been conserved, because teeth have been conserved for so long, mm-hmm. and we're able to look in the past with teeth. I don't know. It's just really cool.
Well, yeah. So that's the thing, you know, teeth is, you know, they're the hardest known biological material, right? So they are the most readily fossilized of all the components of the vertebrate skeleton. Right, so typically cartilage doesn't preserve very well. Bone may or may not preserve well, but teeth really do, because they're made of these really super hard things. So they stay hard for longer. So that means that, you know, during fossilization, those things are going to be retained and not rot and be broken down as readily as bone and cartilage and other soft tissues.
Yeah. So would you not consider teeth bones?
No, but they have, I mean, of course, bone has lots of, there are lots of shared components. So dentine and bone are quite similar in structure, although dentine is a lot harder and it's slightly different in the way it's mineralized. But they're not bone.
They're different. Okay. They're different.
So they're their own, there's bone and there's cartilage and then there's teeth?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Okay. We're learning something new
here.
We
made it.
Yeah. No, I've definitely heard of people refer to teeth as bone. It's incorrect. You know, there may be sort of, in some vertebrates, there's an interesting gradation between dentine, how it's attached to the bone, and bone itself. And that gradation can be lost, right? There isn't a really defined boundary in some cases. And so that dentine to bone transition can be quite tricky. So, but it's not, yeah, but they're not bone.
Very interesting.
Somewhat similar, maybe, but not bone.
I will never say they're bone again. I don't actually know if I've ever said that in my life anyway, but...
Mm-hmm. I know. I was just like, I feel like I should know this, but I really don't. I kind of assumed that they were bone. But...
Right.
Yeah. So with all of this, you know, makeup of teeth being conserved through time, towards the end of your introduction, you kind of posed this really interesting question that I liked a lot, asking why do teeth differ so greatly in form, function, and pattern. Mm-hmm. Do you have a best guess for this? Do we know, you know, like have a definitive answer to this? Or do you think it's just a broad range of things impacting those three?
Probably it's a broad range of things, you know, and I guess a lot of this, I mean, you know, we shouldn't lose the fact that teeth are necessary to eat, right? And to feed, right. And to process food. And so that's really the driver. So the ecological niche, what that organism is trying to eat, right, whether it's acquiring the food and then processing, or just, you know, just grabbing it, right, and throwing it into the gut, the teeth are sort of a true reflection of the ecological setting, right? And so that's why you can sort of almost define the prey based on the teeth, right? So you'll know a meat eater by its teeth, you'll know a herbivore by its teeth, and that's the same when you look at sharks too. You can pretty much tell what they're eating by the shape and the sort of pattern of their teeth. But yeah, but I think why you have such diversity is quite an interesting question. But I think that's the real driver, is the ecology is the driver of all that. And sure, there are evolutionary shifts that may be slightly distant from the ecology itself, right? So group specific shifts that may lead to more teeth, less teeth, different, you know, different patterns. But yeah, but essentially it's pretty well conserved as a developmental process, but then it sort of shifts, right? So, you know, how you use those conserved elements of development and genetics to then shift the dentition to suit whatever it is you eat. But it's also one of these chicken and egg situations, right? So, you know, you can only eat the things your dentition allows you to eat, right? But you need that dentition in the first place to then hunt down those things and process them and eat them successfully, right? So what's interesting is that I study other fish too, like pufferfish, right? And it seems like there's a really interesting sort of division having a dentition that's able to feed on one thing and then shifting through regenerative time to being able to feed on something else, right? So we did the study where we looked at pufferfish. They have as larva, or the larval form of pufferfish, they have, you know, individual teeth, and they're able to eat these and pluck out zooplankton from the water column, right? But after the process of regeneration, they're able to make a beak, right? So they sort of they build up these bands of dentine into this beak, and then they can eat a very specific diet based on whatever niche they've occupied or taken over or taken advantage of in the ocean. So I think the idea that I like to run with is this kind of idea that regenerating your dentition multiple times may allow you to be a bit more plastic in the way you shift your dentition to suit different ecological needs. And if you think about this, this is a sort of a global issue, right? So, you know, the waters are warming typically because of global warming and everything. And so that might shift some of the sort of the landscape of an ecology, whether it's a coral reef or a deep water environment or whatever it is. And so being able to regenerate your teeth and shift what those teeth are and how you then are able to process food might be a huge advantage, right?
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, and so I think there's something to that. If you stop making your teeth and you saying, I'm going to stick with these, thanks, and then everything changes and the stuff you normally eat just dies or moves, what are you going to do, right?
Yeah.
You're screwed. So there are some fish, and so I should explain that there are some fish that do change their dentition based on the availability of food, right?
No way.
So cichlids, there are cichlids that are able to evolve. Yeah, so over regenerative time, right? So they're able to change their dentition to suit the needs ecologically and what food's available. Whether they're eating plants or crushing things like snails, you can actually switch the food and then they'll just switch their dentition.
What? Okay. I just like kind of...
So, yeah, okay. So I have a follow-up question. Let's say that our climate change like accelerates and let's say a certain family of fish or whatever that a certain shark eats just like dies off. Do you think that sharks would be able to evolve their tooth shape quick enough to respond to that?
Good question. So my example just now is a cichlid, and they're really incredible in their ability to evolve quickly and speciate very quickly. Sharks may not be able to do that, right? Because if you think about sharks and their generational time, it's really slow, right? And
right.
So, you know, they don't mature until they're sort of, you know, 10, 13, 14, 15 years old in some sharks, right? So that means you have to spend a long time waiting for that point to reproduce. But that slow process of development and, you know, adolescence and maturation, that might mean that those species then may be slightly slower to evolve. I don't know if that's true, but it's a point that, you know, cichlids are quite incredible. Some teleost fishes are quite incredible in the way that they're able to evolve and speciate more readily than other things. And so I think sharks probably, given the fact that they're sort of long evolving groups of organisms, that maybe they don't evolve so quickly. So my guess is that probably can't happen within a generation like it does in some teleost fishes, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've thought about, like, in terms of climate change, I've definitely spent time thinking about, well, would sharks be able to evolve at the speed that we're changing
right.
the environment that they live in? Mm-hmm. But I've never thought about it in terms of their ability to eat things
right.
and whether or not their teeth would allow them to eat what is then readily available that may be gone at a certain point.
Exactly, right. I mean, yeah, it's tricky. I mean, you know, great whites, right? They eat fish or seals, but if there were no fish or seals, and maybe no humans left, right? Could they eat shellfish? Could they eat, you know, something else? Could they scrape algae, right? Probably not. So they probably wouldn't survive. But other sharks that may have that slightly shifted dentition might be able to take advantage of that, right? So it's kind of an interesting sort of, it's all speculation and hypothetical, but it's all interesting.
Megan and my brains are blown because both of us, when we like have a big self-combustion event, we just like smile at the and camera like... as we process.
Yeah. Yep, that sums it up. I like don't even know what to say because we have a whole list of questions and I'm just thinking of so many more questions as we're talking and learning so much that I'm just like, I feel like we could make this a 2-hour episode.
I know. I mean, welcome to my life, right? I mean, this is the problem. Trying to focus on a specific question is hard.
Oh my gosh. That is so cool. Okay. I am going to move on to a question that I'm very curious about. You write mm-hmm. that in Heterodontus, like Port Jackson sharks, there is no physical separation between tooth types. So are they fused together or what does that mean exactly?
So yeah, really good question, and maybe maybe that was my fault not writing that sentence clear enough. But actually, so what you have typically in mammals is different tooth types, right? If you look at our mouths, we don't have a gap, right? We shouldn't unless you've lost teeth, but you don't have a gap between the incisors, the canines, premolars, and the molars, right? But they are distinct tooth types, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you look at the mouse, which is the model tooth organism, right? So the model organism for tooth development. Mice have incisors and they're separated from their molars by this kind of gap called the diastema, right? And so really the physical separation I was alluding to there was this sort of the division between a tooth type like incisors in mice and the molars. And so if you look at the teeth in Heterodontus and Port Jackson sharks, bull sharks typically as a group, you'll see that they have these kind of nice multicuspid sort of incisor type teeth at the front, and then they sort of, as you work your way back through the jaw, they sort of become these really elaborate molariform sort of crushing teeth. And so what I'm saying is between those two types of teeth there's no distinct boundary. They kind of just, you know, and they're individual units, right? They're not fused, but they're individual units. And so, but you can go from position 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 that all look the same. And then 5, 6 might be starting to sort of fuse in terms of, not fuse in terms of forming together, but fuse in terms of shape shift.
Right.
Right. So they start becoming less incisor form and becoming a bit more shorter and flattened and becoming molariform as you and then that shape changes into fully molariform as you get to the back of the jaw.
Okay. But then later in the paper you mentioned that the tooth roots can be fused.
Is that true? Well, yeah, they're linked, exactly. Yeah. It's true. So yeah, so in some sharks and rays, you might have a sort of a linking of the root. But they're still individual, but they form in a way that means they can kind of fused together, so they're more robust, and that's kind of important if you're a ray because you have this kind of this pavement of teeth used for crushing, right? And if you were to crush something really hard and crack, if those roots weren't sort of interlocked, I guess is a better term for it, then you might break the jaw or the tooth pavement, right? And so you want those roots to be sort of nested together or interlocked to some extent.
Okay, question. Yep. I have like so many questions in my head. So cookie cutter sharks, right? They like lose that whole bottom like block mm-hmm. of teeth, basically. Yeah. Are there any other sharks that do that?
I mean, there are a whole host of things that are closely related to cookie cutters that do the same. So kite fins and a number of other sharks. But that means that actually their dentition is kind of interesting. If you look at the lower dentition, the upper dentition is just completely different. And it looks more like a standard shark dentition, actually, with these kind of nice pointy teeth that are made in a similar way. But the lower jaw dentition, you have the functional positions that are sticking out, and then almost 180 degree flip is the replacement teeth that are sort of facing downward, right? And so once they lose that entire row, right? And you've probably seen this. I mean, there are some kids shows that even discuss this, right? But if they lose the entire row, that second row has to flip into position. And it has to flip almost 180 degrees into position around the jaw in order to be functional. Yeah, it's pretty wild.
So does that mean you talked about, right? You talked about these like two groups of cells that you have to have to create like a blob, for lack of a more educated word from me.
That's a great term,
That then allows the production of the tooth. Mm-hmm. So in a cookie cutter, does that mean that there's just like a really big elongated blob that then creates one big tooth?
No, not really. So yeah, it's kind of tricky. And we see this in piranha too, right, in other fishes. But actually what that means is that every one of those teeth is still individual teeth, but they develop together, basically. And actually what that means is as they grow together, well, they grow adjacent to each other, but they grow towards each other. So that root basically interlocks. So they're all linked. And so that means they can all come up together. And actually, in even in piranha, those teeth, they kind of they're little sort of notches that allow connection of those teeth, so they're linked together, so that when they regenerate a new row, they kind of flip into position all at the same time. It's kind of interesting. So yeah, they're still individual teeth, so not one continuous blob. It's individual blobs that, as they develop into teeth, those teeth then sort of like kind of not merge together, but they'll sort of link together towards the root, the base of the tooth towards the root. Yeah.
Do you think there's any disadvantage to how sharks have evolved their continuous sequential replacement of teeth? Is there any downfall to that, other than like what you were saying, if they can't transition their teeth based on prey availability? Is there any other thing that you could think of that might not be great for sharks?
Great question. To the shark, I don't think so. The only issue is that if the system kind of goes awry and it overgrows, or you know, you produce teeth at a rate you can't sustain. But I don't think there's a disadvantage. I do, you know, sometimes I do have people that will say to me, either, you know, talks or when I talk to the media or whatever, or if I talk to the public, there might be some people that say, well, does that mean that humans will get sharks' teeth? And that's the real disadvantage, right? So if we had a dentition like sharks, we couldn't deal with all those teeth, right? It would be a problem. Continuous growing teeth, you'd be like, oh no, I can't take anymore, right? But in sharks, and the way they live and the way they sort of, you know, their status in an ecosystem, those teeth are perfectly sort of they're perfectly formed and perfectly sort of developed for their need. Mm-hmm. And actually the rate of teeth in sharks is different, right? So some sharks will make lots of teeth and replace them quickly, and other sharks will make lots of teeth and just make them very slowly because they don't need them as much. So so there's a way the system can slow down or speed up based on what it needs, kind of ecologically or dietary.
What's slow replacement for a shark?
Good question. Again, who knows, right?
So yeah.
The great white, I think, probably replaces its teeth quite slowly because it doesn't need them. And it's all based on metabolism and the ability to digest food too, right? So if you're a great white shark and you've just eaten a chunk of seal or a seal head or something, right? You're not gonna process that food. I mean, it's not gonna be ground down or anything. It's gonna be plopped into the stomach and it's gonna sit there until it digests. And so that could take weeks. And so if you were to make two more rounds of tooth replacement in that time, that's completely pointless.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, right? That makes sense.
And so the idea is the great whites, you know, and you often see great whites with damaged teeth too, because, you know, that tooth will come out eventually, but it's not really that necessary because they're not eating sort of hard prey, or they're not eating stuff on a sandy bottom, so their teeth are grinding down or wearing away. So they're kind of waiting for that food to digest before they then go eat again. And so they don't need to eat every day or every, you know, 2 hours or something, right? So that's sort of, you know, that's slow, I think. So great whites probably make teeth at a slower rate. You know, whale sharks may also make teeth at a slower rate because they don't need them, because they're filter feeders. But they still have teeth on their jaws, right?
Yeah. That's so cool.
So if, I don't know how to phrase this question. Do the cells that are creating the teeth, do they know when to make a tooth or not make a tooth based off of space availability?
Good, that's a really good question, because they do. And so if you think about the deepest part of the jaw of the shark, right, where you've gone through all those stages of tooth development because you're going through the conveyor belt, right? So you're following the dental lamina into the jaw, right? And now you're stuck at the end where the end of the cartilage is. That's where you get the new teeth forming, right? And so that sort of scalloped kind of trench almost within the cartilage is the sort of the end point. So the cells can't go further than that end point, right? So new teeth will form there, right? And so within that, you have different pockets of cells within that continuous dental lamina that spans the entirety of the jaw. You have little pockets of cells, and each of those little pockets are associated with each family of tooth, right? So every one functional tooth has a set of teeth behind it. That's what we call a family of teeth, right? And so if you think about that, right at the end of the jaw in that furrow, right, There are some positions that are making teeth actively. And there are some neighboring positions that aren't making teeth actively. They're in a period of stasis. It depends on the type of shark and whether they have this kind of this system called jaw crowding or tooth crowding. Whether you'll have all those positions firing and making teeth at the same time or slightly offset, right? And so the shark that we study, the cat shark, does have jaw or tooth crowding, right? So it has lots of teeth. There's not very much space between those teeth. And the way they do that is by making teeth in a very specific order, right? So if you think about the very first blobs that are forming in the embryonic shark jaw, right? So these are superficial blobs forming on the edge of the jaw, right? And you have position, now think about the numbers, right? So positions 2, 4, 6, 8 around the jaw, right? And they're all made at almost the same time, right? There's a sequential process to that, but essentially they're appearing at the same time. Okay, what about positions 1, 3, 5, 7, right? So they're the sort of the intermediate positions that come slightly later, right? But every one of those blobs, as it starts forming, is on a time sequence. So it's already started the clock, right? So in a very specific time, based on the cells and the genes that are being signaled and all the proteins that are acting around that, that one tooth will then make a second tooth at a specific time point, right? And so if you think, this is kind of complicated, but that offset means that in the furrow of the jaw, where you're making new teeth as an adult shark, one family, so a family in position 2 is making a tooth, but family in position 1 and 3 are not making teeth at that point, right? So they've stopped and they're waiting, yep, because they're on a different time course to the others. So every other tooth is making a slightly different tooth at a slightly different time. So that means you get this kind of zigzag pattern. That means you can crowd more teeth into the jaw and have this kind of like alternate pattern, right? To answer your question, yes, the cells know when to make a tooth, when to stop making a tooth, and that's all based on signals from the neighboring tissue and the neighboring tooth positions as well, right? So essentially, the I guess the bare bones, the building blocks of all this, right? So the basis of all this is that once you start making a tooth as a little blob, that thickened blob, this circular little blob that then grows and thickens into the mesenchyme, right? That's kind of an interesting little unit, because around that, the cells around that are signaling these inhibitory factors, right? So these things are telling the neighboring teeth, don't make a tooth here, give us some space, right? And so if you think about the signals that then move away from that epicenter of the tooth, right, they get weaker, and then after time there's a threshold, right? The weakened signal then is overridden by an activatory signal that then makes a tooth. And so there's a gap between those teeth, right? That's why you have a very specific pattern in sharks, because they know, every blob knows, you know, how big to make that blob, how big to make the tooth, and then the sort of space around it is already sort of inbuilt into that system by these inhibitory signals that are being sort of shot out from that tooth.
That is so incredible.
Right? So it's kind of interesting. This then is a reaction diffusion mechanism by which the cells all sort of signal to each other. They all know what those distance markers are, basically, between those units.
Yeah. So the whole, I was thinking of another question as you were talking, and you actually answered it as you were talking, but we had Yulia Tercher on a few weeks ago talking about different teeth morphologies and how there's sexual dimorphism between teeth sometimes, but it can be based on season. So like during the breeding season, males' teeth will be different. And I feel like how you just explained all of that actually finally makes that make sense for me. Like there's all these cells that are communicating and saying like, hey, not right now, we have this tooth, all of that just like pieced together for me.
yeah, and so that's kind of interesting, that, you know, so, and that sort of touches on something we talked about a little bit earlier on, which is, you know, do sharks have the sort of the plasticity to change their dentition? And in that case they do, right? So hormones really play a huge part in this, right? So how hormones interact with development, right? It's kind of interesting. So some of these sharks do change their dentition based on their sort of like, you know, breeding seasons and other factors, you know, and, you know, I guess males and females have to change their dentition to allow them to do different things so they can actually, you know, copulate and mate. So that's one way. And the ability to regenerate your teeth is important in that, because that means that you can shift the shape, because you're changing your teeth. You're going through different generations of teeth quite readily. So that means you can change, based on hormones, your tooth shape to then put you in a better position to mate and do all those other things.
We didn't follow our outline at all. But I just learned so, like, I feel like that I could go back and read the paper again and understand a lot more than I did when I first read it, even though we didn't go right. as straight with the outline. That was awesome.
I think that means I need to be a better writer. That's the problem.
No, I think that it's like this happens with other papers for me as well, where when I really don't know that much about an area, then it's of course it's going to be so much harder to read papers mm-hmm. that are specific to that. Right. Which I don't think makes anyone a bad writer. It's just like not every paper is expected to be like an introduction paper to sure. what yeah, teeth yeah, right. are. Like, how are you going to write a paper that has a whole introduction to teeth and then explains the mm-hmm. research that you did? But that our this episode just like, wow, it's like,
to me, this episode like truly hit the point of why we're doing this podcast. Like, we had so many questions. To be honest with you, we were a bit intimidated by this paper because we're not experts in this field. And we're like, oh no, are we even going to be able to make conversation about this paper? Right. But instead, like, you just blew our minds. And I feel like we learned so much. So thank you so much for explaining all of that.
Yeah, no trouble at all. No, yeah, thanks for the invite. It's been really yeah. fun. But, you know, this is a good analogy for science generally, right? So, you know, I wouldn't have imagined that my career would have gone through these kind of different trajectories. But, you know, that's what happens, right? You sort of learn new things and you go, oh, hang on, that's really cool. That's not what I intended to do, but that's really cool. I'm going to follow this path now. And I think this conversation probably just shows a little bit about that sort of that process of science thought, right? And not just following a specific path, but allowing your creativity sort of, you know, and also your, you know, the things that sort of really interest you and those little moments where you think, hang on, I hadn't thought anything about that, but now I'm going to be doing this because that's really cool.
Oh my gosh, it really is.
100%.
Is there anything that we didn't talk about in the paper that you think is important that we should bring up before we wrap up?
Good question. I don't know. I mean, you know, the thing is that sharks are really incredible, right? So they are masters of regeneration, but not in the way that most people think, right? So, you know, if you talk to people, they're like, oh, sharks don't get cancer and they're able to regenerate everything really, really readily. You know, it's not necessarily true. They do get cancers and they can't regenerate everything. But actually the one thing they can regenerate is their teeth. And they're able to do that because they have maintained this embryonic tissue, this dental lamina, right? So it forms during embryogenesis, so really early in developmental time, and they don't change it, right? So they use that dental lamina, that embryonic tissue, to make their teeth, and they continue developing teeth all throughout their life, right? That's pretty incredible. And there are very rare, I mean, there are very few opportunities to study these kind of embryonic tissues that don't die, that are maintained in their original state, right? So that embryonic tissue is still there in an adult great white. It's still there in a 450-year-old Greenland shark, right? That kind of blows my mind that there's yeah. this kind of embryonic. Yeah, it's almost the exact same tissue that formed as an embryo, right? And so, you know, given all that, you know, having the opportunity to study that tissue and understand its capacity to regenerate and what it can tell humans about regeneration generally and tooth regeneration, I think it's just incredible. So I'm very lucky to be able to study yeah. this stuff.
Thank you so much. We learned so much. I'm going to be thinking about this for the rest of the day for sure.
Well, yeah, thanks for the invite. Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. We're now to our favorite part of the episode where we ask if you have a field story you'd be willing to share. I know, are you in the field as much? Or are you in the lab more? It can be really from any.
Yeah, so I guess that's a good question. So I'm getting more and more in the field. I mean, actually, you can imagine that most of the work we do is it's basically in the lab, looking at sort of dead things and studying cells and things that aren't moving as much. But yeah, but I'm starting to go in the field a bit more. I mean, we've been on boats. I've been out with OSearch and a few of the other groups, looking at big sharks and trying to scrape. Dental lamina cells from great whites, which we did, and we were able to keep. Yeah,
I would
and
love so, to see that shark so, yeah, dentist.
Yeah, exactly right, and so we're actually trying to sort of think about the cells in a bit more detail. So we're trying to take some cells from embryos, from adults, and grow them up in the lab. And so because of that, we do get to do these silly things like try and sort of like, you know, scrape some oral cells out of a great white's mouth. So that's kind of strange, I guess. That's not something that I would have predicted we would do, but yeah, I mean, no, yeah,
not in your life bingo card.
No, that's right, exactly.
Do you have any pictures of you doing that?
You know, so I don't want to say too much, but OSearch, the team we were out with, they're very they hold their cards close to their chest, so they don't allow us to do very much with any of the footage. So yeah, we don't have images of that. We were not able to do any of that stuff. But yeah, but I do other field work. So actually in the summer, last summer and this summer, I'm going out to Friday Harbor.
I'm going to see you at Friday Harbor because I'm also going.
Are you there too? That's great. Yes. Yeah. So I was there last summer, my first summer out there, and I'm there teaching the REU program. But that's really cool because it allowed me to think about a whole different group of fish, which are closely related to sharks, actually, the chimeras. These sort of weird deep water things that are related to sharks, so cartilaginous fishes and chondrichthyans, but not sharks. So I was able to dive and capture on film these chimeras. And actually, one of the things we were studying was this tenaculum, this kind of forehead clasper that they have, right? And it's this weird club-shaped thing that has a dentition, right? It's a really interesting thing. It kind of looks like the oral teeth of sharks, but they're able to shoot this thing out, right?
Yes.
And so it's interesting. So they use that, we think, to clamp onto the female during copulation. But we don't really know very much about this thing. We don't know much about
so
these fish.
So weird.
And so, yeah. So
I went
on this night dive. So I was studying this. We had dead chimeras. And we had some that we'd caught via trawler. But I actually wanted to see them in the wild. So I think it was two nights before we left. I did a night dive with a colleague who studies octopus at Friday Harbor. And we did a night dive. And we saw a few of these chimeras, and we have one that came up to me and didn't really know what to do, and then just shot its tenaculum at me. So I've got it on film, but I don't know if it was like a defensive thing or whether it liked me and it was like, you know, a cat purring or something. I don't know what it was.
Attractive chimera.
But it didn't take off. It kind of stayed. It actually stayed with us for about 15 minutes. Circling and coming back, and it wanted to be played. We were able to stroke it. It was incredible.
Wow.
But yeah, so that was the thing. We were studying this really weird structure, and we were able to sort of film it during a night dive, and it just shot this tenaculum at me. And I was like, whoa, that's so crazy. And I was like, because, you know, it was cold and it was dark. And I was like, I hope I got it on film. So I did have it, and I do have a video of it. So yeah.
Can you share that video with us?
Of course. Yeah, sure.
Yes. Cool.
I think I've got one where I do a slow-mo of it so you can actually see it a bit more.
Yes. Oh wow, I'm so excited.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah, if you're willing, we'd love to use that to help advertise for the episode.
Yeah, of course. No trouble. Yeah.
This might be one of my favorite field stories, to be honest.
We got a bonus field story.
Yeah. I mean, I think that might be my favorite story ever.
That's amazing.
Because, you know, it's often difficult, you know, and I think, you know, I'm not an ecologist. I'm not a true marine biologist. So I don't get to swim with, you know, my model organism. And because usually they're in the lab and they're dead. But this was one of those opportunities where it was just like everything came together in that moment. I was like, wow, that's crazy.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Okay. We have to wrap this up because I do think that we could talk for 2 hours easily. But Dr. Fraser, where can our sharkies follow your work?
You can follow me on Twitter, which I post a bunch of things on Twitter. I think my handle is very simple. It's Gareth J. Fraser. That's it. No Great. Spaces or gaps. Or my website, Perfect. Which is Fraser Lab. So Fraser-lab.net. And that's where all my research and, you know, lab stories are posted. So.
Amazing. Okay, we're going to follow you and keep learning so much about teeth. Thank you so much for being here. This has been incredible.
Yeah, thanks for your questions, guys.
And until next time,
swim you later. Wow, it's like, oh.